You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com. This episode of the Archaeology Podcast is sponsored by Digital Training from the Center for Digital Archaeology. Visit digitaltraining.site for more information on high-quality archaeological training webinars that you can join in from anywhere in the world. That's digitaltraining.site. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, Episode 5. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Swedish archaeologist Dr. Martin Rundqvist about his work in Europe on Bronze Age archaeology, and other things he's working on.
Let's dig a little deeper. Okay, we're here on the Archaeology Podcast, and we're here with Dr. Martin Rundqvist. We're gonna pronounce it that
That's
way for his benefit. All right, so Martin, why don't you just give us a brief little biography about yourself and what you do. And you're in Sweden, so just so our listeners know that.
I'm in Stockholm, Sweden, as I've pretty much always been, excepting a couple of years as a kid in Connecticut. But I did my PhD at the University of Stockholm in 03. And since then, I've published another couple of monographs, and I edit one of the bigger journals we've got over here in archaeology. So I'm basically your standard member of the academic precariat on short teaching contracts or no contracts and short research stipends.
Nice.
Mainly doing research, actually, and enjoying that a lot.
Okay. Isn't Stockholm where they're doing the Nobel Prize awarding today, I think?
Sure. Yeah, that's my hometown.
Nice. All right. Well, when you do win a Nobel Prize, at least you won't have that far to go, right?
That's very good. Exactly. Because they don't pay you the prize in advance. So you'll have to probably pay the air ticket by yourself and then collect the money, which would be a problem. But I can walk.
Nice. All right. Well, let's talk about your blog real quick, because that's how I first found you years ago when I was looking at archaeology blogs. And you've got a blog called Aardv Archaeology, and we will link to that in the show notes. But why don't you tell us a little bit, when you started that blog, because you've been doing it for a long time, I think, and then kind of what your blog is about and what people can get when they go there.
Yeah, it's kind of venerable by now, actually. I've been on scienceblogs.com with that blog for 10 years. Wow. Prior to that, I had a smaller blog on Blogspot. But it's about archaeology and history and music and books and whatever sort of strikes my fancy. In recent years, a lot of the shorter ideas I get end up as Facebook updates, and then I collect them a few times a month. Because I have an unreasonably high opinion of my own ideas. So I call that pieces of my mind.
Nice.
I basically don't really feel any compulsion to act as a news service for archaeology. I just write about the stuff that really interests me. And of course, with a heavy Scandinavian slant, as your listeners will know, archaeology is not one global subject. It's 3,000 regional subjects, and there are chronological specializations in each region. So a Stone Age expert in Stockholm doesn't need to read the publications of a high medieval scholar in Stockholm and so on. I mainly do past like 3,000 years in southern Scandinavia. That's my bit.
Nice. Now, how did you I'm just curious this, because I kind of slowed down on my blogging a little bit just because I podcast so much now, so I figured my opinion's out there enough times. But I'm wondering, how did you seek out science blogs, or how did you get picked up by those guys?
Yeah, I just sort of wrote them and said, here's what I've been doing the past year on Blogspot.
Nice.
Would you like to put me in your stable? And currently, Science Blogs is a pretty decimated place compared to what it was like in 2006. It was in 06, it was a pretty hot place. It was bankrolled by this genius kid in New York with his inherited money. And a lot of people have gone on to greater things or to lesser things, and there's a few of us left. I think there's a bit, maybe like 17 or 18 active blogs still on the network, but it doesn't play the part it did in 06. And maybe also you could say that blogging doesn't play the part it did in 06 anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely true.
But it's good fun though, because I'm a journal editor and I know what editors are like, so I really enjoy being able to put whatever I like out without having to think about an editor.
That was a question too. So Science Blogs doesn't moderate your posts at all. You can, as long as you maybe stick in the realm of you don't divert from science too much. I would imagine you can't turn your blog into something about cooking, I would imagine, but
Well, actually, I've never run into any problems with that. But I'm not the kind of blogger who seeks controversy. I'm not interested in trolling online. So, mm-hmm. Of course, I have one or two controversial opinions, but they're mainly controversial within the very limited realm of Scandinavian archaeology. So, the only time anything like that has come into my view at Science Blogs is when they created the adult content tick box mm-hmm. backstage. So if I write something extremely pornographic one day, then I will, for the first time, have to use that tick box. And I think it has to do with advertising, because some advertisers don't want their their ads to go up along something really raunchy. But that's not what I'm about, so it's not really a problem.
Well, there you go.
Actually, I did once blog about a pressure flaker. It's a tool used mm-hmm. for fine flint working. They found one in Sweden that had pretty much a dildo in one end and a pressure flaker in the other end. So if the adult content box had existed at the time, I would probably have had to tick it. But that's the only time, really.
Wow. Nice.
The dildo was like one third of an inch thick, so it's probably more symbolic. I don't know.
Wow, nice. All right, well, let's move into to some of the stuff you're doing over there. So you sent us a few papers, and I like how you mentioned in the beginning, you know, with blogging and what people are interested in, things like that, is there's, you know, not one world archaeology. There's like, you know, lots and lots of regional and specializations. But in one of the papers you sent us, well, actually, it's a book, In the Landscape and Between Worlds. You talk about landscape archaeology, and you specifically talk about, you know, drilling that down into even tighter focus of just, you know, I'm standing on a hillside. What can I see from here? And what does this mean in, you know, the time period that I'm researching? Can you talk a little bit about what kind of drew you to landscape archaeology and what you're doing in that realm right now?
Yeah, that's fun. That was the book I put out last year mm-hmm. about the Bronze Age, like 3,000 years ago, pretty much in the Stockholm area, actually. Didn't want to travel too far. So the idea there was, as you say, that the landscape scale level is stuff you can walk around and experience in an hour or two of walking. It's not the perspective of the single site where you're sort of looking at something that's 400 yards long, but it's not either the scale level where you're putting dots on a map of Michigan. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the intermediate level. And what I did was I went into the museum catalogs and I looked at all the Bronze Age metalwork and battle axe finds from this period. And I tried to find out where exactly were they found, because nobody's cared about that before and nobody's had access to the data in the way we have now with the internet. So I managed to find almost 200 of these sites where I could point to one piece mm-hmm. of dirt and say that this is where they found this stuff in 1859 or whatever. And then I could start to look at this more in aggregate and generalize. I'm not very interested in the kind of landscape archaeology where you're trying to understand one site. You're wandering around sort of feeling the vibes, like mm-hmm. the English scholar Christopher Tilley has advocated. So I tried to make this into sort of a general phenomenon to look at from a slightly higher point. And I managed to find some what I like to call landscape rules. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that when these people are sacrificing bronze objects and these really nifty polished axes of stone, they're not just doing it randomly. They're not tossing them over their shoulder. They are selecting places of special significance. They like rapids and rivers, and they like hourglass-shaped lakes, so they will throw axes into the narrows at the middle of the lake. Hmm. They like the mouths of rivers and the heads of rivers, where they debouch from a lake. That's a good place to sacrifice axes and jewelry and stuff. Because if you excavate these people's settlement sites, it looks like the Stone Age. They don't deposit bronze where they live. Instead, you find this stuff when you when you drain wetlands, or if you dredge rivers and stuff in the area. Mm-hmm. So that was fun, because a lot of the other categories of site from this period have been looked at from a landscape perspective. So we sort of know the rules for where a good place for a settlement site is, or where a good place for a grave is. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that you could slot the sacrificial sites into this model. And that's interesting, because that makes them more predictable for contract archaeology. Mm-hmm. I've been pitching this book pretty heavily to my colleagues in rescue archaeology, contract archaeology, because I'm hoping that they will be able to find these sites more proactively, not just wait around for some farmer to find them, as we have before.
Mm-hmm. So this was something I actually found really interesting in your article, where it's not necessarily this strict experiential approach to landscape, and it's also not the broad overview where you're sort of looking at where all these sites are. It somehow falls in between, where there is sort of an experiential aspect to the patterns of deposition of these sacrificial objects, where you talk about people looking for, you know, distinctive landscape features or water features that kind of stand out. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and why people might have been choosing these areas for these kind of sacrifice deposits, and also define what those are for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with kind of European hoards and artifact sacrificing?
Yeah, well, we should say first that this is a completely prehistoric era. So this is hundreds of years before Homer, and Homer wasn't even in this area. So there's nobody writing anything relevant. So we can't sort of cheat and ask them what they're thinking. So we have to infer what they were thinking from their behavior. And I think it's pretty clear that they're trying to communicate with somebody who is in the water. Because it happens that they may sacrifice in caves and hillsides and that sort of thing, but that's a very small number of sites. When they have a good chunk of bronze objects that they want to deposit, then it's usually in a wet situation. And they're kind of funny, because this being, or those beings they're talking to, are super particular. So you'll find them loading a canoe full of bronze and paddling it across the sea to an island, and then carrying the stuff up onto the island and depositing it in a small lake on the island. So they couldn't just put it in the sea, because that's wrong. That's a wrong number. You cannot call God here. But also they choose these scenic spots, like the south end of these long gravel ridges that crosses the post-glacial landscape in this part of Sweden. So they will climb up onto the south terminal of these things, and preferably close to water. And you've got these really shiny, polished bronze objects that glint in the sunshine on the south end of this thing, and they will go into the ground or into... There's even a case where they found a bog on top of the ridge. So they sort of found a micro version of the wetlands they usually sacrifice in, and they stick like 15 objects into the tiny kettle bog on top of the ridge. And, what are they hoping to get out of it? There's been a debate about this, and there's been all kinds of weird economic interpretations where they're trying to make bronze more scarce, because otherwise there will be inflation in the value of bronze. And I mean, if I'm a bronze owner, I will be very happy if you guys get rid of bronze to push up the value of my stuff. But I can't really see a mechanism where I would be motivated to get rid of mine, because if I get rid of mine, my bronze, yeah, the value of your stuff goes up, but that's not quite what I was aiming for.
Do you know if they had a value?
I don't want to be too specific. Oh yeah, this stuff is not free. This stuff is very clearly traded for, because in Sweden there is no tin ore, And okay. The copper ore in Sweden is only available to somebody with a pretty advanced mining technique. Mm. So the Bronze Age is this weird interlude in Swedish prehistory where they have to import every gram of the most important material for their technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, before the Bronze Age, they were fine. They were napping local nappable stones available everywhere. And after the Bronze Age, they're getting iron ore out of the bog behind their house and making iron in a small furnace in the yard. Mm-hmm. So they were fine there too. But the Bronze Age here is 1,200 years when they have to trade for every gram of this stuff. Nobody in Hungary, nobody in Ireland is going to give them the bronze just because they're so nice.
Right. So what can you, before we go too much farther.
When I say Hungary and Ireland, that's actually how far.
I was just gonna say, before we go too much farther, and I think we're getting some Skype lag here because, you know, around the world. But yeah. That's okay. Can you explain just for our listeners, what is the actual time period for the Bronze Age in Sweden?
Well, we define it from the day when they quit making their most important cutting tools out of stone. And mm-hmm. that's like 1700 BC.
Okay.
Calibrated. And then it goes on to sometime in the 6th century BC. So it's a bit less than 1,200 years.
Okay.
And they actually use the bronze. It's not just sort of magical or symbolic. They mm-hmm. They make symbolic objects out of it, but they also make the most humble knives and axes of this stuff. And compared to something made out of quartz or chert, these are pretty good tools. So there is a technological incentive to switch to bronze. But of course, there's this huge body of ideas around it too. We know mm-hmm. that from the rest of Europe, because they're all reacting pretty much in the same way. So you get this complex of sort of dialects of a pan-European Bronze Age where the design of the stuff will be subtly different in different parts. The Scandinavians are pretty funny because a lot of the bronze they're buying is already cast into workable objects when they get it. Hmm. So they're not sort of getting bars out of bronze, they're getting axes. But they don't like them because they're, I don't know, German axes or Hungarian axes. So they recast the stuff when it gets into Scandinavia. So mm-hmm. we've got something called the South Scandinavian Bronze Age culture. And they've got this amazing, completely original version of the European Bronze Age, where everything is decorated and designed in a slightly different, characteristically Scandinavian way.
So was bronze used, you've mentioned all the objects and things made out of bronze. Was it actually used as like a currency or anything as well, besides just the objects? Did they make like coins and stuff out of it, or did they trade it as a currency, or was it solely in the realm of like objects that they could, you know, use for some sort of symbolism?
They were not using currency in the way we think of it. There was no sort of monitor very aware of the weight of objects. So if you look at a lot of these things, they are weighed in units that are known from Egypt and the Near East, that sort of thing. Apparently the amount of bronze you got was not just contingent on somebody's good mood that day. Mm-hmm. The people who traded you the bronze knew how much bronze you were getting. And they probably wanted something in return. And the answer to that question that many scholars give is amber. Mm. Amber can be fished out of the Baltic Sea and also the parts of the North Sea, like southern Denmark, eastern Netherlands.
Okay.
And also fur. Furs, because northern Scandinavia is obviously super cold, so furry animals get really nice furs there, and that's throughout prehistory and history, that's been a really important trade good around okay. here. And when these people show up in history, then they're big slavers, but mm-hmm. that's later, so we don't really know about the Bronze Age. There's there's Roman poetry where nasty poets are accusing Roman society ladies of not having their own hair. Their hair comes from the head of a Germanic boy, uh-huh. that sort of thing. So maybe the Romans were interested in people with unusual hair colors, that sort of thing. But to answer your question, this stuff is not symbolic, at least not completely symbolic, but it's not currency either.
All right. Well, we'll dive into that just a little bit more right after the break. Back in a second.
At digitaltraining.site, we believe that spending money on learning is great if it helps you solve a problem. If you're a cultural resource management professional, you want to make your workflow faster and more efficient to beat your competitors. If you're a student or young professional, you'll want to learn marketable skills to get that job. If you're a faculty, you want to stay up to date with teaching topics, but you feel overwhelmed by all the technologies and tools out there. Digitaltraining.site is for you. You'll get relevant topics by top-level instructors and downloadable materials at an affordable cost. And if you're an enrolled student, apply for a scholarship and attend for free. Start learning now at digitaltraining.site.
So before we head on to another topic, I think we have a couple of follow-up questions from our last segment. So one of the things that, Martin, you started to talk about is just the extent of the connections of Bronze Age Scandinavians to other parts of the world, you know, where they're getting this bronze from, the trade in amber and all these other goods that are being produced. And I think that's something that we as archaeologists often struggle to think about, is just the extent of contacts and ties and movements of people around in these, you know, prehistoric worlds. So what are the ties? What is the extent of this for Scandinavians?
Well, it's huge. We've recently, just in the past couple of years, learned a lot about population genomics in Europe in general. And it turns out that the most common, like three Y chromosome haplotypes in the Swedish population, just looking at every male in Sweden, the biggest groups are groups that enter Sweden and during the Bronze Age. So they've only been around, the majority of our male genome has only been around for less than 3,000 years, most of it. So it's what this means is that we see some immigration of very successful people at this time. Because obviously, if I'm sitting somewhere half-starved, cut off from the rest of society, I'm not going to leave a lot of footprint in the genome, in the population. And we know from imported objects and the sort of cultural diffusion that the world has always been more or less wired together. But the genetic studies has really underlined that, and it's also made any idea of sort of racial purity or Aryan supremacy completely untenable, because everybody's super mongrelized. And it's not just in Sweden, it's all around, everywhere. Quite fascinating. I mean, my wife is Chinese, so I'm keeping up a proud tradition.
That's actually really interesting when you think about kind of the history of using archaeology to kind of prove historic precedents for things, that now all of a sudden archaeology is proving that we really are this incredibly interconnected group of people that have been interbreeding and interacting for thousands of years. And it's hard to draw these really concrete national lines or identity lines.
Yeah, it's a 19th century fantasy.
Yeah, oh, that's really interesting. All right.
You know, they found at a Roman cemetery somewhere in southern England just a few months ago.
No, I hadn't seen that one. Huh.
Oh, yeah, it's been around the news very recently, and they looked at their genes. Skeletal morphology so far, but these guys are very clearly far travelers that ended up in a Roman cemetery in England.
Martin, real quick, I want to bring it back to the landscape archaeology discussion and something that you mentioned when you were talking about that. That interests me because I am I'm a contract archaeologist here in the United States, and you mentioned coming up with, I guess, rules for landscape archaeology that you could then apply to a different landscape and say, well, it's likely that we're going to find this here, here, and here. Can you talk just briefly about what you know about the contract archaeology, industry in Sweden and how well it works? I mean, I know how it works over here, but how much archaeology is done by contract archaeologists in Sweden? You know, how does that interact with, say, academic archaeology?
Well, it's 95% of every excavation. In Sweden. So we barely have academic archaeology if you're looking at the field. Almost all excavations in Sweden are prompted by land development, and it's well-funded, and I like to say that we have the world's strictest monument protection because we have the world's humblest monuments. So it would be very, very hard to apply our legislation anywhere else, maybe Finland. if you try to enforce Swedish heritage legislation in Israel or Italy, everything would just stop. Mm-hmm. People wouldn't be able to go out the door in the morning because they would be breaking the heritage law. But in Sweden, we protect tar production pits in the woods. Mm-hmm. And we protect the footprint of a charcoal kiln in the woods from the 19th century. And recently we have had a change to our protection law that says that if you find an object and it dates from before 1850, then you are legally obliged to offer it to the state for a consideration.
Wow.
But that was kind of a mistake. Because they were actually aiming for standing buildings, you know, industrial heritage, that sort of thing, and they thought that, well, people are stupid. We need to make these rules really simple. So let's put the same cutoff date on small objects. Mm-hmm. And the people writing the changes to the law didn't realize that this would smash right into the new rules for metal detectors in Sweden. Mm-hmm. So the poor metal detectorists, they go out to the beach. Where they've very, very grudgingly been given a permit to use their detectors. Mm-hmm. And after half an hour, they find a coin from 1849, which turns the beach into an ancient monument. And they have to notify the county archaeologists and immediately make a new application for a new beat. Mm. And this, of course, means that the county archaeologist's office are completely gridlocked. It's a sad story. But anyway, contract archaeology, there's a built-in frustration that I like to mention called I like to call it the field archaeological paradox. Mm-hmm. In Sweden, if a site is really, really interesting, the more interesting it is, the less likely it is that you will get money to excavate it. Because almost all excavations are contract digs, mm-hmm. and they are preceded by evaluations where archaeologists tell engineers where the stuff is. And then the engineers slalom around the interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the contract business, you always end up 400 yards from the interesting site.
Right.
Because we want to keep that for the grandkids.
Right.
What you can do is try to work on railway projects, because high-speed trains, they can't slalom.
Right.
Their curvature is sort of limited. So they often smash right into really good sites simply because there's no other way to build a railway, or it will be a low-speed railway, which mm-hmm. wasn't the idea. I mean, it's a high-speed railway. So I was lucky very early on in my career to work on a couple of railway projects, which went into some really fat stuff. That was really nice. But I don't work anymore in contract archaeology. I've only done 3 seasons in that. And that's partly because a lot of the stuff you get to do is rather, shall we say, humble stuff. And right. I'd rather not. So I've focused on research and then I've been very lucky to collaborate with students and with the daylight variety of metal detectorists, good, honest people with special skills. So they're great. The students and metal detectorists like to work for free, which is exactly what I need.
Exactly. You know, that to get those kinds of sites over here where a project is just going to mow through something, typically it's got to be like a mine out here in the West, or like an open pit mine out in the West where they're taking a massive amount of area and anything inside of it's pretty much going to be destroyed. Or pipelines, like you said, pipelines I've seen have the same problems. If it's in the later stages of development on the pipeline, then, or if it's in the early stages, they can sometimes do a reroute, especially here in Nevada. You've got a bunch of open land. But like you said, if they're already laying pipe down in certain areas and we're still working in other areas, if you just pull that pipe over just a couple hundred meters, that moves the entire line for several miles. So, you know, you're right. You can't just they can't just put a little jog in it. They have to move the entire thing. So I understand that with the high speed rails. Yeah. But I'm also interested in the 1850 rule, which is really interesting to me because we're about to have an episode on the CRM Archaeology Podcast discussing the somewhat absurdity of our 50 year rule. I mean, if something is 50 years old, we have to record it. That's the typical rule. I mean, that's 1966 at this point.
A friend of mine has excavated Prohibition bottle dumps outside of San Francisco. I think 50 years is ridiculous. But then I belong to those who don't much like what they call contemporary archaeology. I think if you can still call the guy who made the site, then you don't need to excavate the site.
That's a good point. That should be the metric that we have to use. You know, if the person giving you the permit is older than the site that you're recording, then you probably shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
Which is typically the case out here. Yeah. So no, that's good. And you know, I always kind of subscribe to the idea of you know, because we do have other things like National Register criteria. We have the National Register of Historic Places, and there's four criteria which you can get something listed, and that's not necessarily age dependent. Like for example, you know, the 9/11 site in New York is on the National Register of Historic Places, given the fact that it's not 50 years old because it's historically significant. So I feel like we should just apply those criteria to everything. If this is just a can dump from the 1950s, you know, do I care? But is it a can dump associated with a homestead associated with somebody who did important things in that area or was an important historical figure? Then maybe now we record that sort of thing. But, you know,
I'd say that would not be a good path to take because then you would have to decide who's important.
Well, that's true.
So,
it's all sticky questions.
I think that's part of the 50-year cutoff here, too. And maybe the 1850 cutoff is there's a moment where you don't know that it's going to be really significant because it's so contemporary. And then, you know, 75 years down the line, people go, oh, that actually really did matter. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Well, and now there's no one to talk to and we don't have the sites anymore. So
it is a
really tricky situation, but you know, they've run into that with certain types of buildings where, you know, no one likes brutalist architecture. So we tore it all down, but now we don't have very many examples of it. And so it's a really interesting problem, I think, is when does something matter and how do you determine that? And you don't want to gum up the system.
I'm a prehistorian. So my criterion is, can I learn something I don't know from the site?
Right.
And you can learn a lot about brutalist modernist architecture by simply by visiting the library.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even have to be a brutalist library.
Nice. Well, you know, we started this discussion by talking about, you know, contract archaeology in Sweden, but the second half of that question was, why don't you talk about a little bit about some of the landscape rules that you came up with and developed that can help actually contract archaeologists and other people. Because I think one of the things that interesting that I read in one of the quotes I think you had right at the beginning of that book was about how a metal detectorist had kind of already figured this out. And then everybody else comes along and says, hey, this actually does work. We can look at these things and say, you know, site predictability and stuff like that. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and the predictability of where sites can be.
Yeah, the detectorist you mentioned, that's a quotation from a paper by Richard Bradley and a co-author where their detectorists in southern England, they realized that there's something called the spring line at the base of their hills where a rainfall on top of the hills comes out at this line of springs at the base, sort of seeping through the sedimentary rock. And the Bronze Age people are really interested in those springs. So that's where they deposit their bronze. And the detectorists learned that simply by trial and error. And the archaeologists twigged it when they realized that, hey, this is the fifth time in as many years that the same guy shows up with a new hoard. It wasn't just these people moving randomly across the landscape. They figured out just when you're picking mushrooms, where is it worthwhile to walk?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the rules are very different in different regions. So you can't, there's no pan-European standard behavior for bronze deposition. In the part of Sweden that I looked at, it's super important with the wetlands, and they keep a pretty constant distance from other types of contemporary sites. So we have luckily, they had this weird behavior around household waste at their settlements. So particularly in the later parts of the Bronze Age, they build little mounds of their household waste, which can look a bit like burial mounds, only small. And if you sort of scuff the moss off them, then they largely consist of cracked stone from heating water. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got this big wooden tub and you fill it with cold water, you throw glowing hot stones into it just to transfer heat, and the stones break and can't be used again. So they build these little mounds, so it's pretty easy to find their settlements, and they're always a mile from, I should say it the other way, the bronze deposition sites are always about a mile from the nearest set of cracked stone mounds, burnt mm-hmm. mounds. Likewise, this is an area with rock art. The Bronze Age is the big rock art era in Scandinavian prehistory. Yeah. And the nearest rock art site is always also about a mile from the deposition site. So that's a really good rule of thumb to start with. Where am I? Am I in a liminal position, so we're sort of on the outskirts of the Bronze Age landscape, or am I in their business? Because mm-hmm. There was this idea in earlier research that bronze deposition and deposition of axes was something you did in secret, sort of way out in the woods, in the borderlands. But it turns out that no, you can usually see their homes from the deposition site if the vegetation permits. Mm-hmm. So that was one interesting result, and that's also very easy to do methodologically. You just use the sites and monument register and the measure tool. So yeah. You measure on the map. And of course, when I say it's about a mile, or for Scandinavians, it's about 1.7 kilometers. That's knowing what we know today. But mm-hmm. 2 years from now, we will have identified more rock art and more firecracked mounds. Mm-hmm. So this average distance can only shrink. It can never grow. Okay. The grandchildren will have a lower average distance. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. And then also that they're super interested in when the water does something. So they rapids, they keep coming back to this area's very few river rapids, just time and time again over hundreds of years. And there's been this idea that, yeah, they remember that there's been sacrifices here before, but I think they don't. They just keep noticing the rapids.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the reason that you get like 2,000 years of recurring depositions in a set of river rapids is not that they have this huge oral tradition. It's just that you cannot ignore river rapids if you believe in some power that lives in the water.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I've got some follow-up questions on the rock art, but we're going to do that right after this final break, and we'll come into our final segment here in just a minute.
Telling a different story to the traditional lines of archaeology, the An Archaeologist podcast seeks the stories and ideas that are often overlooked or not considered real archaeology. Video games, anarchism, and archaeology in the middle of hostile areas. Host Tristan doesn't search under the rocks. He destroys them. Available on iTunes every fortnight.
All right, we're back for our final segment. And I have a question about the rock art that you just mentioned in the last segment. I'm curious because I'm really into rock art out here in the American West, out here specifically in the Great Basin, and found quite a bit of it actually. And I'm curious with all you said the Bronze Age is where a lot of the rock art happens in Sweden, is the time period. Is the rock art similar or a reflection of some of the Bronze Age bronze artifacts that they have as well, or is it more abstract, or what kind of iconography or symbolism do you see in the rock art in Sweden?
Well, basically they have two main motifs in this area. The most common one is simply cup marks, which I believe is their way of doing the Hail Mary. So a cup mark is, as it sounds, just a small cup pecked into a rock, but they will do like 70 on the same rock. Or 300. So it seems that the important thing is not to make a cup in the rock and then use it for something. The important thing is to make them, not mm-hmm. not to own them. So just as one Hail Mary will not get you into heaven, if you do 72, then you're in good shape with the powers. Then the second most common motif is figurative, and it's boats. So we have one of these boats. It's slightly after the Bronze Age, but it's exactly the same technology that they're depicting very clearly. And it's not hard to understand that they're into boats, since the basis for their technological existence must be taken to Sweden by boat, the bronze. So we're pretty sure that the people who got the power in society at this time are the people with the boats. Okay. Also, they believe that the sun can only travel across the sky and back under the underground to where it goes up again by boat. So part of the sun's circuit is traveling by boat. Also, it's getting pulled by a cosmic horse part of the way. The top bit across the zenith, there's the cosmic horse. And that's the only bit of Bronze Age mythology that survives into the written record of the Eddas in the Viking period and the Middle Ages, the cosmic horse. Yeah, and you asked about objects. They do depict bronze objects quite happily in rock art. So they depict them in such detail that you can date the rock art from the types of objects they depict. And also, they sometimes put rock art designs on metalwork, which also helps cross-date the rock art chronology to the greater chronology for the Bronze Age, which is largely based on fine combinations from graves. But the rock art is different in different regions. So around where I am, it's pretty not super rich. But if you go to the area of Gothenburg, one of Sweden's larger cities, you'll get awesome rock art with these really complicated scenes of people apparently performing rituals and guys with enormous erections fighting with axes. And it's amazing stuff.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So I think in the interest of time, because we want to talk to you about a bunch of other things, you sent us a few different papers, and April is going to ask you some questions about one of them.
You'll have to have me on more times.
I know. We've got so much to talk about. But April's going to pepper you some questions about Vikings now, because everybody loves Vikings.
Yeah. I was thinking about this. I was like, there's certain time periods and groups that everybody is fascinated with. And so you're actually an archaeologist who gets to research one of them and gets to work on Vikings.
I robbed their graves.
Well, you know, it's turn on. So I have to start with a slightly nerdy question, but seen the Viking TV show? It's very popular here in the States.
I have not. I know that they wear biker leather in the TV show, that is. I can tell you that we do not find much evidence for that in the archaeological record.
Oh, well, that feeds well into one of the questions I was going to ask about some of those portrayals of material culture. But I recommend you check it out. So next time we talk to you, you can give us a rundown as a Viking archaeologist of what you think of our American portrayals.
Loud
of this.
Drones and gnashing of teeth.
Nice. Yes, I'm sure they all do.
The first thing I'd like to say about the Vikings is that a Viking, that's a job. It's not an ethnic term.
Right.
That's good to point
out. Most people in Scandinavia in the Viking period are not Vikings, and most Vikings are only part-time Vikings. You're a Viking when you're young because you want to get rich and buy a farm and settle down and have 7 kids. Maybe in the Danelaw or in the North Atlantic in one of the islands there, or maybe at home in Sweden or Denmark or Norway. The term the Viking Age is something that British historians made up, because to them it's simply the period when we had all the trouble with the Vikings. So in Scandinavia, it's less sensible to call the period the Viking Age, because we used to do the Viking things for 1,000 years before you guys got wind of us. So the Scandinavians would raid each other mercilessly for 1,000 years. It's just that they only had rowboats. But it couldn't raid the French and the English. It couldn't get that far. But the moment they developed sail technology, wham, Lindisfarne.
Yeah,
that's nice. Really interesting. So the project you were involved in was a little bit more, not mundane, but looking at a house mound, a big platform mound. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how this fits into kind of our popular conceptions and misconceptions about, this Viking era and Viking culture, as we call it?
Yeah, that was a really nice one. This is outside of the small town of Vadstena in Sweden. There's this enormous mound shaped like a loaf of bread. And it's people have been wondering a long time for what this is. And it's been floated, is this a sort of natural or is it a burial mound with a weird shape? And one of my old teachers from Stockholm University suggested, no, it's a house platform for a longhouse, just like the ones in old Uppsala, which is known from the written record to have been sort of the main power and religious center of the Swedish tribe. But this site outside of Vadstena is not in the area of the Swedes. It's in the neighboring tribes area, in the, what you would call the Geats or the Goths, which are not the same as the continental Goths. Anyway, they had in the 80s, they trial trenched it and found that it is in fact artificial, and they got an articulated rear leg of a horse out of it, which gave a radiocarbon date probably in the 8th century, so like exactly at the start of the Viking period or slightly before. So it's really weird. It looks like a tennis court. It's got a flat top, and it's the flat top is 50 meters long. So a very talented younger geophysicist that we've got in Stockholm, Andreas Wiberg, Dr. Andreas Wiberg, him and me, we went down on Saturday morning with GPR, ground penetrating radar rig. And I moved the elastic laundry lines across this flat top of the mound, and Andreas, he walked backwards across the mound to and fro for a total of, was it maybe 10 hours or something? And then we thanks to this, we could simply tell the world that, yeah, there was a 50 meter long banqueting hall on top of this structure. It's not a burial mound. It's a house platform. And this suddenly elevates this village outside of Vadstena in this part of Sweden to the level of old Uppsala, which is the ceremonial center that everybody knows about. So it's suddenly we see the contours of this petty royal family who never made it into the historical record. So they're there in the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries, and they're burying their dead with these really, really rich graves that have been excavated. And only now do we realize that, yeah, we've got their house too. We've got every post hole. We know where it is and where the central hearth was, and we can find exact parallels to the architecture at Old Uppsala. The best parallels to this building's layout is from Old Uppsala. So not bad for 10 hours of field work, and of course a couple of days of data processing by Andreas afterwards.
I got a question about the mound real quick. Would the mound that this was constructed on, would the mound itself have been constructed, or is that a natural formation that was basically leveled so they could construct the longhouse?
No, the mound is constructed. Okay. It's built out of dirt from an older Iron Age cemetery. So it's full of bits of bone and potsherd. And if you want to be symbolic about it, you can say that this was usually significant. And I'd say that's probably likely in the case of the Viking period, because we see them time and time again doing strange stuff to earlier burial sites. Mm-hmm. They're not just being vandals. I think they're... insecure pagans. The Viking period is when they leave paganism behind. So we see them time and time again reusing bits of the pagan material culture in really odd ways. So, you know, Gotland, the island in the Baltic, they have these beautiful pictorial stelae. We call them picture stones simply. They're like rune stones, only with pictures instead of runes. Mm-hmm. And there's two contexts where you find these picture stones. You either find them mortared into churches, sort of reused in churches, or you find them as lid slabs on the last generation of pagan graves on Gotland. Hmm. So they're picking them up and reusing them as lid slabs or headstones hundreds of years after they were erected. That's typical for a Viking period behavior around all sorts of things, that they kind of want to get in touch with the happy happy days of unquestioned paganism.
That's really interesting.
So it's not bad. So the mound is definitely artificial. We knew that already in the 80s, but nobody thought that the important stuff might be on the top of it. Everybody sort of assumed that the interesting stuff will be under it.
So you talked about using GPR on this project, and that's something I'm personally really interested in. Would you mind just defining what GPR, ground penetrating radar, is for our listeners who might not know and have run into this before, but then also kind of talk about its use and prevalence in Sweden?
Yeah, it's one of the many geophysical methods. Ground penetrating radar is the same kind of radar that is used at airports and in fighter planes and everything. Only you send it into the ground instead of horizontally across the ground surface, and it'll bounce at different things. It'll bounce at interfaces sort of between the cut and the fill in a sunken feature, like a post hole or a hearth pit or a grave. It'll bounce against the water that collects in a pit of stones. It will bounce against the stone itself. So depending on what kind of feature you're looking for, GPR is often very rich, and it'll show you a lot of stuff. Whereas magnetometry, I've had some bad experiences with that, where it will only show you the stuff that has been altered by heat. So you'll find lots and lots of hearths and nothing else, or metalworking pits or that sort of thing. If you visit a site where somebody's working with a GPR, ground penetrating radar, then you'll see somebody who's apparently walking backwards with a small lawnmower or vacuum cleaner. And that's the measuring equipment. You can have bigger setups, like a four-wheel motorcycle pulling this elaborate cart behind it with measuring equipment on it. But that's a bit more high-end. Of course, this stuff is being developed every year. It gets better and better. And because of Time Team, you know, the English TV program, everybody in the UK knows what geophys is. It's become a household word for them, because Time Team's big idea was that they would geophys the site, and then they would only excavate the best bits, so they would only have to excavate for 3 days. And that's how they made each episode. And as I said, I mean, with traditional methods to find out that, yeah, this 50-meter long mound has all the post holes of a huge banqueting hall on top of it, doing that would have taken weeks, if not months, with traditional methods, and also it would have messed the site up. And this is just a lawn, so we just pulled our vacuum cleaner across it for a couple of hours, and here we are. We can give you the plan of the thing. But geophysical methods are growing in importance in Sweden and elsewhere. GPR is not the only method, but different methods are good in different contexts, I guess. And I think it's definitely the way to go. An interesting perspective is that if you excavate a site, you ruin a lot of the data that you could have collected with GPR or magnetometry or any kind of geophys. So it's kind of unethical now to excavate a site without first making sure you have geophysical data.
Right.
Because you're going to screw that over with your trench. So. Yeah. Next time, when somebody finally runs geophys across the site, they will get this blank rectangle in the middle. Oh, and they'll say, oh, that was Rundqvist in 2016. He vandalized the site. He excavated without using the geophysical equipment that was available in his day.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we've only got
good stuff. And
go ahead. So I was going to say, we've only got a couple minutes left. So and April actually had to leave us because she's off to the airport for some holiday travel. But I just want to, you mentioned Time Team, and I've heard other people from the UK mention that same aspect about Time Team, how it's just like it ran for so long that it's just common for people to know certain things that they definitely wouldn't know as common knowledge over here in the United States. Kind of building on that, what is sort of the public perception of archaeology in Sweden? You mentioned 95% of the archaeology being done by contract archaeologists. I know people over here, well, typically, you know, you have your supporters, but then you have a lot of people in industry that are just like, you know, these guys are costing us time and money. And of course, we've got the Dakota Access Pipeline fiasco going on right now. So what How do people see that over there in Sweden? Is the general public generally pro archaeology and history and research, or, you know, do a lot of them see it as a hindrance to progress like people do here in some cases?
I'd say that the typical Swedish attitude is one of benevolent ignorance. They kind of know about archaeology. They don't care much, but they're fine with it. They can't always tell archaeology apart from paleontology. They will mention dinosaurs, but they're kind of interested, and they think it's interesting to meet one of these fabled creatures, the archaeologist. as for the money aspect, there is no political opposition to it at all. There's no party in the Swedish parliament who wants to make it cheaper. It's largely because public road building and public railway building is all done by the same state department called the traffic department, and in the context of a major highway project, the expenses for contract archaeology are completely negligible. It's basically what they pay for paperclips on such a project. So nobody's looking at the smaller numbers in the budget for the traffic department and saying we need to excavate fewer of these tar-making pits in the woods. I'd say that we have a good relationship with the public, and it's getting better and better thanks to the fact that the poor public is now also funding outreach. It used to be that outreach was not included in excavation projects, and then they realized that, hey, should we really be paying all this money just for nerdy archive reports that nobody has access to? So now developers, that is usually the traffic department, have to pay for a pretty hefty amount of popularization and outreach as well, which of course make people more interested. And even though they're paying a bit more, they're also getting more out of it.
Okay, well, I think that's about time. As with most of our shows and interviews, I think we could just go on all day talking about this, but we'll have to.
Yeah, this was fun.
Yeah, well, thanks, and we'll have to refocus. And you know, next time you have a publication or a book or something come out and you want to talk, we'll bring you on the show and let our listeners know about it. So, thanks, Martin, for coming on the show, and hopefully we can talk again in the future.
Many, many thanks. Goodbye. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. This show is edited by Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. Go check it out. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.